by no means is Saudi Dawah purposely tried to create in jihadism, but Salafism is often part of what extremist groups believe. But there was so much scrutiny on this form of Islam after 9/11. I think the internet has played a really big role in accelerating this ramp between Salafi or Wahhabi books and preachers into far more extreme radicalization. But it's undoubtedly true that Saudi Dawah has done a lot to spread Salafi ideas everywhere in the Muslim world, including in Europe.
Diese Stimme gehört Krithika Varagur. Krithika Varagur ist eine amerikanische Journalistin und Autorin. Als langjährige Auslandkorrespondentin in Indonesien und Südostasien berichtete sie über Religion, Politik, Fundamentalismus und Extremismus, unter anderem für The Guardian und The Atlantic. Zusammen mit dem Historiker und Journalisten Christoph Münger beantwortete Krithika Varagur die Frage, welche Ziele hat Saudi-Arabien? Den Talk hielten die beiden am AHA-Festival im Januar 2022 in Luzern. Jetzt wünschen wir euch viel Spaß mit dem Talk über die Ziele von Saudi-Arabien.
Danke vielmals. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Krithika Varagur. Just if you allow me to say a few words to the audience about you. Krithika Varagur is an award-winning American writer and journalist. She's a graduate from famous Harvard University. And in particular, and that's why we are here tonight, she's the author of this book. I present it here, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. I was told it's also on the shelf upstairs where you can buy it afterwards. The book, The Call, is an intriguing study about the Saudi effort to export Wahhabism, the very ultra-conservative version of Islam. And of course, Krithika Varagur goes into the topic by doing research in different countries. What about the impact of this project, the so-called Dawa project? And she's been in the country with the largest Muslim population, that's Indonesia, but she was also in much smaller countries, so small as Kosovo. That's what we are going to talk tonight here. For several years, Krithika Varagur was a correspondent in Indonesia and also in South Asia and Southeast Asia in general. Furthermore, she reported from Africa, from Nigeria, and from the Balkans. Her reports were published in very distinguished media outlets such as the Atlantic, the Financial Times, The Guardian in particular, and also the Washington Post. And most recently, I've read that Krithika Varagur was a columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Krithika Varagur, what was your column about in the Wall Street Journal?
It was about my generation, which is millennials, and what it's like in the workplace for this generation. I was given a pretty broad berth from the CIA, which is the American Intelligence Agency, to the growing marijuana industry, and everything in between.
Oh, great. Would also be a great topic, of course, maybe next time. But tonight we are going to look at Saudi Arabia and its Dawa project. You have described in your books. First, in the first part, I would like to talk in general way or about the Dawa project. Then we could turn to Indonesia, where we've spent 4 years, and then to Kosovo. And finally, I would also like to discuss a bit the implications for Switzerland, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So you describe in the book I'm presenting to the audience again so that they really buy it afterwards. You describe in your book, The Call, how Saudi Arabia actually exports Wahhabism, this brand of ultra-conservative Islam. So could you please tell us, that's also the title of this evening, why is Saudi Arabia doing this? What is the aim behind this project?
Absolutely. So the title of my book, as you said, is The Call. And the title comes from an Arabic word called Dawa, which means the call to Islam. And da'wah can mean a lot of things. On one level, it's just the duty of every Muslim to embody the values of Islam and just, you know, kind of implicitly call anyone they come into contact with into Islam. On the other hand, it can also refer to more explicit missionary activity, whether it's proselytization, directly encouraging conversion, sending Qurans, and so forth. And it's the latter kind of da'wah that's been uniquely prominent in the history of modern Saudi Arabia. And that history, keep in mind, is not a very long one. Saudi Arabia only became a country in 1932. Before that, there were a series of tribal kingdoms. There were several dynasties ruled by the House of Saud. This was the third one, but in what we'd call a modern nation state, only came together in 1932. And the most prominent feature of the country, which is the discovery of oil, happened in 1938. Both of these things were essential to what we would later call Saudi da'wah. So from the start, Saudi Arabia, which was never colonized by a European power, was formed from this power agreement that dates back to the 18th century between the Royal House of Saud, the Saudi royal family, and the Wahhabi clerics under the leadership of a very famous preacher named Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab. He became famous in the 18th century for basically wreaking havoc on the Arabian desert with his unique interpretation of Islam, which centered Tawheed, or the unicity of Islam, to the exclusion of a lot of other things that had come to be associated with Islam. So the Wahhabi form of Islam was very much against things like visiting tombs, celebrating the Prophet's birthday, singing, dancing, and all kinds of things that they considered extraneous to the kind of total and submissive worship of the Muslim God. And because of the pact that he signed with the Saudi royal family, the Saudis have always been Wahhabis, and the Wahhabis have always been Saudi. And that continued to be the case when Saudi Arabia became a 20th century nation state. So although they were a kind of country that had to form a government and send diplomats abroad and, you know, form an army and things like that, they also had to make a place for the Wahhabi clerics. So when this new country developed a foreign policy, it was really important that the Wahhabi clerics have a say in the foreign policy. And of course, the main tenet of what they wanted to do was spread Wahhabi Islam. So, you know, at the time that this originated, it probably may have left no impact on the world whatsoever. But as we know, over the course of the 20th century, Saudi Arabia became incredibly rich with oil revenues. This started in some way when oil was discovered in the 30s, but it really skyrocketed in 1973 with the embargo of the Arab-Israeli War. And that's kind of the origin of what we would now think of as Saudi petrodollars. That's when this really started just pouring out. So because of this enormous explosion in funds, the Saudi Wahhabi da'wah suddenly had a ton of resources behind it. And in the 50s and 60s, in the post-war era, Saudi Arabia had also gone ahead and created several institutions that this oil money could go into. Keep in mind, they had good reason to do this because Saudi Arabia, the country we call Saudi Arabia today, or the regions that composed it in the past, is the birthplace of Islam. It's home to Mecca and Medina. It's where the Prophet received the message of Islam. It's where he did the Hijra, and it's where the Holy Quran was revealed to him. So the two holiest mosques in the world and the direction in which all of the world's 1.8 billion Muslims pray is towards Saudi Arabia. So they had some serious claim to legitimacy in creating some of these institutions, like the World Association of Muslim Youth and the Red Crescent, which is the Islamic variant of the Red Cross, which many of you in Switzerland would know quite well. So in the 1970s, as oil wealth exploded, they were able to push a lot of money into all kinds of these international Muslim organizations that not only carried the Saudi name, but also the Wahhabi da'wah, of a very stringent and somewhat intolerant form of Salafi Islam. The one thing, if I had to convey one thing about the nature of Saudi money in the Muslim world, it would be that there's no single source of it. It comes from the government, it comes from princes and individual members of the royal family, it comes from a number of nonprofits, and it comes from Saudi embassies all over the world. So the reason I, you know, did so many separate case studies in my book, which goes to three different countries, is because the precise effects of Saudi Dawa has been very different everywhere it goes.
Thank you very much for this historic introduction. But nowadays, talking about Saudi Arabia, we come, of course, across the name of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who became quite infamous because of the Khashoggi murder in Istanbul some time ago. So what is his role in this Dawa project, in this proselytization project of Saudi Arabia?
It's a great question. And he is one of the youngest heads of state of all time. He's still in his 30s. And although he's a member of the Saudi royal family and has to pay some respect to the Wahhabi clerics, he's done more than any recent Saudi ruler to curb the influence of the Wahhabi clerics. The main reason being that he is an authoritarian, and the Wahhabi power base is an alternative power base that draws power from his government. So he, for example, has single-handedly eliminated the role of the religious police in Saudi Arabia, which used to, for example, like punish people who were violating the dress code and violating all kinds of Islamic principles. He just eliminated that in one day with one decree. He's also jailed a number of prominent Wahhabi clerics, which shows that he's not really afraid of them and doesn't feel quite as much pressure to maintain the legitimacy of the clerical base as his predecessors did. That being said, he recognizes that the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia, is a really important source of revenue for the kingdom and an important form of cultural prestige for Saudi Arabia around the world. So he has had to make some improvements to the pilgrimage ministry specifically, and to facilitate it, especially during crisis events like the pandemic. But I would say overall, his modernization plan, which has been called Vision 2030, emphasizes a lot of things before the religious part of Saudi Arabia. I think there's a sense from him that he wants Saudi Arabia to be known for things other than religion and religious influence, and a little bit more for things like technological innovation.
Yeah, we've read about that, but you personally, are you optimistic regarding this crown prince?
I'm optimistic about his rule in general, or about his influence on the religious establishment.
The influence on the religious establishment, of course.
I think it's undeniable that he has already cut down the religious establishment quite a lot. And in fact, when I went to the Saudi embassy in Jakarta in 2019, it was much different than it had been just 3 years ago. It was covered in Vision 2030 materials, and they had vastly cut down on a lot of their in-country activities and proselytizing activities as part of this Vision 2030 push.
So, but of course, in Saudi Arabia, religion and politics are quite strongly interlinked, and they go both together. So, for example, has Saudi Arabia supported the Taliban advance in Afghanistan last summer?
So, you know, their geopolitical considerations, especially in the Middle East region, are pretty specific and constantly changing. But the reason I looked at places in the greater Islamic world in my book, especially in Asia and Africa, is because they have somewhat different symbolic cultural relationship to Saudi. So in terms of like specific political outcomes, I don't think Saudi Arabia has supported specific politicians or parties in places like Indonesia and Nigeria for a very long time, if at all. It's true that some of the very influential Saudi-educated preachers and politicians have gone on to shape politics in their countries, often with a very religious bent. But it's less like a direct line correlation between what Saudi Arabia wants.
Yeah. But so coming back to this Dawa project, you have mentioned some fights going on between the political leadership and the clerics. So who is behind this Dawa project, and in particular, who is paying for it? Is it the state of Saudi Arabia, or is it the mosque, or is it both?
Again, that's a great question. There are a lot of people behind it. There is a single Dawa ministry, a dedicated Dawa ministry in Saudi Arabia that oversees a lot of their religious attachés, which is a diplomatic post under the ambassador in a lot of different countries around the world. And for example, that ministry oversees dollars spent on mosque renovations, sending Qurans abroad, and things like that. But there's so much that happens outside the Dawa ministry. And furthermore, the dollar amounts are very let's say, estimated, because they're not extremely subject to external inquiry. So we have to take them at their word for these figures. But outside the Dawah ministry, there are really big charities like the World Association of Muslim Youth and the Islamic Relief Organizations that are also sending out a ton of materials all the time. And in addition to that, the Saudi royal family has over 2,000 members, and more of the more pious members of the family also have their own charities that they might find pet projects in. And, you know, to give one example of a charity that works completely outside the government, the Al Haramayn Foundation was one of the main foundations with links to Al-Qaeda cells in the Balkans in the 1990s. And that was not from the Dawah ministry. It was just kind of like a mysterious charity headquartered in Saudi Arabia that happened to be linked to all kinds of concerning developments in Southeastern Europe. So there's it's kind of like whack-a-mole. There's always a ton of different people sending money into it. In terms of the government itself, I would say that number has gone down in the last decade.
So, but how have you worked for your book then? I mean, that sounds quite complicated. Have you adopted the method of the famous Watergate reporters, just follow the money, or what have you done?
That was definitely my goal going into it, to follow the money. And I would say I tried to focus on the outputs of Saudi money in these countries. So the specific influential preachers in each country that were educated in somewhere like the Islamic University of Medina, which is this university in Saudi Arabia, founded in 1962, explicitly designed to train foreign missionaries from other countries. So in all three countries I visited, Kosovo, Indonesia, Nigeria, Medina educated preachers have been very influential in creating hardline Salafi movements and encouraging Islamist political party. In the case of Indonesia, there's also a Saudi university in Jakarta. It's a branch of a university in Riyadh. So I visited the university several times. I interviewed a lot of people there and their alumni to learn exactly how classes work there. And it's kind of interesting because they have recently started admitting female students, but the female students are on a different level and they can't be in the same room as the male students. So they watch the same lectures on a video screen. So these are things that I wouldn't know unless I visited
in person. Even before the pandemic.
Yeah, so they were early adopters of remote learning, at least the girls. So I think I have tried to follow the money. The sources of the money are far more mysterious than the outputs of the money.
Mm-hmm. Do you speak the language then? Do you speak Arabic? Can you understand? Or how do you work with them?
So in Indonesia, I do. I'm fluent in Indonesian. I lived there for several years. In Nigeria, most of the people I met with did speak English, but I worked with several great translators and fixers who spoke Hausa, which is the major language of northern Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And in Kosovo, I unfortunately don't speak any Albanian, so I worked with a couple of very talented journalists and fixers there as well. And I have a working proficiency with Arabic, especially in terms of reading reports and things like that. But the local languages, it was a wide spectrum.
It's very difficult, of course. I understand very easily. You've mentioned now the countries you've visited. Let's turn to look a bit more closely to Indonesia. Barack Obama, he spent there 5 years as a child. He returned to Indonesia in 2011 as the U.S. president, and he even visited his old home. And he remarked, I quote, a more fundamentalist, unforgiving interpretation of Islam. So he attributed that to Saudi influence, some sort of Arabization he talked of. You moved to Indonesia 5 years later in 2016 as a correspondent, especially for The Guardian. So what was your first impression when you came there?
Well, you know, I started hearing this same line within weeks, if not days, of moving there, that everything was different now, that Indonesia used to be this quote-unquote peaceful country of a unique kind of animist form of Islam. And then Saudi money changed all of that, which led to the kind of fundamentalist and extremist currents that I was seeing as soon as I moved there in 2016. I thought this was an interesting claim either way. I didn't have much to go on, but I did grow up mostly in the post 9/11 era in America, and I had heard a lot about Saudi money in that context as well, especially because 15 of the 19 hijackers of the Twin Towers were Saudis. So I was like, I flew halfway around the world, and I'm once again hearing that Saudi money has changed everything about the religion in this country. I just realized there were very few details as to whether that was true or not, but it was too interesting not to investigate. So that's exactly why I started writing articles about how the Saudi university worked, who the Saudi alumni were in Indonesia, what influence they were having. And as I started to nail down the specifics, I started to form a picture of Saudi money that was very different from the way people were talking about it, mainly that it was from many places and not from one, and also that they had less control over its effects than you might expect.
But still, I mean, I think from the point of view of the Dawa project, the Saudi point of view, it must be quite difficult to push this Arabization in a country like Indonesia. I mean, of course, it's a huge Muslim country, but I guess Indonesian culture might be quite different from Saudi culture. So how do they do this practically? Just they distribute the Qurans, or what do they do?
A big note of influence was the Saudi University for them. And, you know, Indonesia is a big country, but it's very much a developing country. So the way to make the university attractive immediately is to offer free scholarships to everyone who attends it. So that's a hard offer to refuse already. And especially outside Jakarta and some of the smaller villages, building mosques or sending preachers creates a lot of goodwill in places without a lot of resources. And they've also been very conscientious to translate a lot of their Dawa materials into the local language, in this case, Bahasa Indonesia. So when I, when I interviewed people who used to work in the religious attaché's office, he described this very thoughtful plan where the Saudi religious attaché would set up outposts on like every island of Indonesia, which is a huge archipelago bigger than the United States. Just to be a local node of Dawa. And in all those places, at least a few influential Salafis came out of that outreach. So in the 20th century, in the pre-9/11 era, they did give these local and regional heads of Dawa a lot of leeway to like use money in the way that they saw fit, to hire a lot of local preachers to be on their payroll and to really integrate with the local community in that way.
When you talk about Indonesia, we just remember the very impressive pictures coming from the Aceh province after the tsunami in 2004. I mean, in those pictures, there was just the mosque left, where the only stone building, and everything else was flat of Banda Aceh, the capital of this province. Has this catastrophe been a big chance for the Saudis to get into Indonesia by providing aid to the people who really suffered from this catastrophe of a century?
I certainly thought that was going to be the case, because the Saudi formula of charity and aid relief plus missionary activity is kind of a signature move. And I was like, what could be a bigger theater for this kind of aid than the place that was razed by the tsunami? I went to Aceh several times, and actually it was there that I discovered the limits of Saudi Dawah, because I thought the Saudi charity campaign there would have completely transformed Acehese religious life because they had so little after the tsunami. But in fact, Acehese also have a very strong regional identity. And they said, we'll take your charity money, but don't try to take over our religious life. To the point where they were clashing in the streets and fighting over control of the main mosque of Aceh when they started to feel like this Saudi-educated imam was trying to take over the Grand Mosque. So the Acehese really mounted a strong resistance to some of these Salafi ideas because they have such a rich Islamic tradition of their own. And, you know, going to visit the Saudi charity office there and even the Saudi university there, I realized they had really been cut down to size. Unlike in Jakarta, the Saudi university branch in Aceh is only allowed to teach the Arabic language. They're not allowed to teach other classes. So They really put their foot down and said, we're going to draw the line here. You can't just do whatever you want just because we've gone through this tragedy.
So you could feel some sort of a resistance towards the attempt to influence everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So, however, the West also sent aid at the time. Millions came from Europe. The U.S. Navy sent the ships and helped the people at the shore of the Aceh Peninsula. Has there been no impact of the Western assistance in Indonesia, or could you feel that?
Oh, there certainly has. I mean, Banda Aceh, the capital of Aceh, is absolutely beautiful today. And that's entirely due to the enormous amount of aid money that came their way after the tsunami. But I would say that for the most part, the UN and Western countries will not condone missionary activity as part of their official aid package. And that's the Saudi difference.
Most of the time.
And in any case, most of the time, I'm sure that there were other missionary or other organizations trying to do other activities. I haven't looked into, for example, like Christian relief in those areas. I know in India, there were definitely other religious charities from Christian and Catholic backgrounds in South India. But it would not have been received well in Aceh, which is the only Indonesian province with Sharia. So I don't think Christian missionaries would have gone out of their way to proselytize in that particular province.
It's maybe a good idea, overall, yes. Yeah.
You know, overall, just to connect briefly to Kosovo, like when Kosovo was being rebuilt, the UN and US aid efforts very much did not include religious. They felt it was just not appropriate to include a lot of religious component to the aid, whereas the Saudi and Gulf charity saw no problem with that.
You've mentioned it. Kosovo is much closer to us. It's part of the Balkans. It's part of Europe. It's an hour away with an airplane. But Saudi Arabia is also very pleasant in this very small country. Why is this the case?
So, you know, Saudi Arabia was very active in Islamic relief during the Yugoslav war and the end of Yugoslavia and all the small countries that came out of it, often at great cost and high civilian toll, like Bosnia and Kosovo, which are two of the main Muslim majority countries that came out of the former Yugoslavia. And I like to think of Kosovo as the last big Saudi Dawa effort before 9/11, which changed everything, and we can get into a little bit later. The reason why it was pretty cut and dry, I mean, Bosnia, as many of you might know, was one of the biggest humanitarian crises and on the world stage in the 90s. And Saudi Arabia had, at this point, two decades of really strong experience distributing aid and charity and things like that. So they were very heavy on the scene in Bosnia when it became independent in 1993. And then Kosovo, when the same thing happened in 1998-99, they were among the first countries to offer humanitarian relief. There were planes flying almost every week with humanitarian aid. And it was kind of a no-brainer for them to stick around once Kosovo became a country. But they were not unique in that case. As you know, a NATO bombing helped Kosovo become independent. So there were a lot of people on the scene. But, you know, for Saudi Arabia, it was a perfect theater for aid, because this is this 98% Muslim country in Europe itself. The square footage is very small. So from their headquarters in Pristina, they were able to reach most of the country. And in a place that had been, you know, Kosovar Albanians had been traumatized in many ways during the war, but one of the ways was for their religious identity. You know, Serbian forces shot at minarets. They purposely destroyed Muslim places of worship. They killed imams. And a lot of Kosovar Muslims were traumatized on a religious level. So the only kind of charity presence speaking to that fact was Saudi and Gulf money. Whereas the UN and US and things like that were focused more on institutional support and peace building and supporting camps and things like that. Saudi Arabia was among the only people who were educating imams. They were giving scholarship for imams from this war-torn country to study Islam. They were giving Qurans to people who had maybe not seen them in years or decades. So that's why the Saudi dawah was so much received in Kosovo at the time. No one else was really trying to fill this gap except for them.
So they were very welcome then at the time in Kosovo, the Saudis.
Sorry?
The Saudis were very welcomed they were liked and appreciated in Kosovo.
Initially, they were certainly appreciated as alongside most other international aids. And it wasn't until maybe a decade later that people started to realize what exactly was happening as a result of Saudi-related imams and what kind of messages they were bringing. So the resistance to those messages didn't happen until much later. But in the immediate aftermath of the war, they were not questioning it too hard on ideological grounds.
I mean, you write in your book that the Arabs also destroyed Muslim cemeteries.
Absolutely. So, you know, part of the Wahhabi interpretation is that it's very intolerant towards competing strains of Islam and also towards specific kinds of iconography and Ottoman type cemeteries. Of course, Kosovo used to be part of the Ottoman Empire, so a lot of their monuments and mosques have that visual aesthetic. So it's definitely true, according to imams I spoke to there, that Saudi charities kind of took the opportunity to destroy quite a few heritage sites along the way.
So you mentioned 9/11, that changed everything. I mean, of course, you said it before, 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers had saw the origin. So was that some sort of a wake-up call regarding the Saudi attempts to influence even in Europe, as you increase the influence even in Europe, such as in Kosovo?
Yeah, 9/11 did change everything, in part because this was such an extreme event by a jihadist organization. Al-Qaeda became a household name overnight, although they had, of course, existed for quite some time before 2001. And there was a lot of scrutiny on what this ideology actually was. So, and I make this very clear in my book, in by no means is Saudi Dawah purposely tried to create in jihadism, but Salafism is often part of what extremist groups believe. But there was so much scrutiny on this form of Islam after 9/11, which, by the way, was followed up by two Al-Qaeda attacks in Saudi Arabia itself in 2003 and 2004. So Al-Qaeda really became a big problem, not just for America and the West, but also for Saudi Arabia themselves, that the international community started to crack down on Saudi financial transfers to other countries, started to shut down tons of charities in all kinds of these countries, so like in Nigeria, Bosnia, Indonesia, Philippines. Any Saudi money almost overnight became very suspect. And the Financial Action Task Force started to heavily review outflows of money from Saudi Arabia, which is why in a country like Nigeria, the once enormous Muslim World League, by the time I visited in 2018, had been reduced to just a single person. And he said the taps just turned off after 2001. There was no more money coming his way.
That brings us to some sort of successors of Al-Qaeda, the ISIS, the Islamic State terror group. When you write in your book, The Call, that there was even an Albanian-speaking IS unit in Syria and Iraq because there were so many ethnic Albanians from Kosovo, Albania and Macedonia. So how could jihadism take root so deeply in Kosovo and all the other neighboring countries?
I think the internet has played a really big role in accelerating this ramp between Salafi or Wahhabi books and preachers into far more extreme radicalization. So, you know, one thing Saudi Arabia is always splitting hairs about is that Salafism and Wahhabism is a peaceful religion in their view and does not advocate for violence. Of course, at the same time, ISIS has used Wahhabi textbooks in its own schools. So some of these books really can go both ways. And it's such a fine line that it's not an accident that so many Saudi-affiliated alumni have been linked to extremist cells in all the countries I visited. So, you know, with regards to Kosovo and radicalization, the fact that Saudi Arabia was influential right when Kosovo became an independent country and funded a lot of the mosque preachers there meant it created a pretty strong base across the whole country of Salafi preachers. And then once people listening to such preachers were able to get online and access the very prolific environment of videos and messaging channels and Facebook groups that came out of the early days of ISIS, it just became very easy for some young people to, you know, fall into that kind of trap door. I wouldn't say it's by design, but because the internet accelerated some of these things so fast, in Kosovo we just see this happening faster than in a lot of other countries.
But could you provide us with some figures? I mean, we have Kosovo. What about France and Belgium? And where are the most ISIS members coming from?
I mean, I think Belgium has been considered one of the big hotspots for radicalization and jihadism in Europe. But the role of Saudi money is pretty complex, which I know is not the answer anyone wants to hear. But it's undoubtedly true that Saudi Dawah has done a lot to spread Salafi ideas everywhere in the Muslim world, including in Europe. But in terms of the radicalization dynamics in places like France and Belgium, a lot of it is related to local context of laïcité and the marginalization of Muslim communities there, which has also led to a lot of disenfranchisement among Muslim communities and created a large bed of potential recruits for these very active online organizations. So again, I think that, you know, Saudi-oriented Salafism plays a small role in terms of providing this ideological framework for many people. But as for making the decision, the extreme decision to join a terror group like ISIS, there's a lot more at play.
But you write in your book that I think in Kosovo has contributed more foreign fighters per capita, of course, than any other European country.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I think this base of Salafi knowledge in Kosovo is very directly linked to Saudi charity after their independence. Like the fact that there was even this pool of people interested in Salafism, I trace to some of these dawah efforts after Kosovar independence. But as for the actual jihadism and extremism, by the time ISIS was created, there was really no Saudi money coming into Kosovo directly.
Still, I mean, Kosovo is a completely different country than Saudi Arabia. What about the role of the women? I mean, Kosovo has a female president, Yosa Osmani. And doesn't that help to contain the Saudi influence?
I mean, I think the Saudi influence has been countered for many years in Kosovo. For example, the Islamic Community of Kosovo started in 2013 to crack down on foreign Islamic charities. And especially after the advent of ISIS, the government has done so much to control its borders and especially like movements of people who seem radical, and to also temporarily shut down Salafi preachers. Some might even say overstepped their mandate to do that. But they've really, once ISIS became a threat, the Kosovo government and the Islamic community did a lot to try and crack down. But the fact is, a lot of people managed to go before they really woke up to the fact that this threat was within their borders. And it wasn't until some of these awful videos started coming out with the Albanian-speaking commander I mentioned in my book that they started taking it seriously. So, you know, in some cases, it was too late because hundreds of people had to go before these happened. But I highly doubt that this precise kind of foreign charity is going to happen again in Kosovo. And in fact, it's very successfully been beaten back in Bosnia, which is a country I originally thought I was going to write about in my book. But when I visited, I realized there was really nothing to write about. Like, they had done a great job. They had done a great job reasserting the Bosnian Islamic community's modus operandi in their country.
Is this also because of the strong Western presence in the area? I mean, Americans are, of course, in Kosovo, the European Union, even a Swiss military unit is in Kosovo. Does that help to contain these movements?
That's hard to say. You're totally right. You can't go to a village in Kosovo without seeing a USAID sign somewhere still, and there's still a ton of UN presence there. But I think that Western countries and institutions tend to have a secular bias, so to speak. So they often won't feel comfortable working with the religious sphere in general, which is why a lot of their counter-extremism initiatives in a place like Bosnia or Kosovo often don't reach the people they're meant to. So I would say I would credit more the efforts of the indigenous Kosovo Islamic community than the presence of outside organizations.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you see the future for Kosovo regarding this question?
I think the future of Kosovo and to some extent of Albania and Bosnia is that these countries are just going to be much less secular than they were in the 20th century. There's widespread religious sentiment in Kosovo, and 98% of them are Muslims, though there are, of course, some Christians there as well. So I think as their native Islamic community finds its legs and starts to have more resources so they don't have to send people on scholarships to Saudi Arabia all the time, they'll start to reassert their own kind of distinctive Balkan variant of Islam, which really is absolutely fascinating. It's a centuries-old tradition. They have a lot of their own traditions to draw on. I think the Saudi interlude and the fact that some of these horrible things happened in the ISIS era have driven home the need to articulate their own traditions even more.
So now we've talked about Indonesia and Kosovo, and I would like to turn to Switzerland, of course, because we are here. What about the Swiss situation here? Do the Saudis follow their policy of Islamic proselytization also here in Switzerland, maybe on the outskirts of Lucerne, where we are at the moment, actually?
I don't think there's a great Saudi Dawah presence in Switzerland per se. And of course, Switzerland has a very small Muslim population, fewer than 1%, I believe. But also, there's, you know, the Islamic community in Switzerland has a very interesting history. But something they have in common with Saudi Arabia, which I wanted to just flag, is that when the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt split apart, many Muslim Brotherhood members fled to Saudi Arabia and started working on political Islam there. But some of them also came to Switzerland during that time, which is some of the earliest roots of the Muslim community here. But in terms of Saudi Dawah in Switzerland, I don't think there is a very big presence.
Still, we've talked about the significance of Kosovo in the Saudi Dawah project. And in Switzerland, there live about 200,000 people from Kosovo and Albania and Macedonia. About half of them has even a Swiss citizenship. What do you know about the Saudi influence on migrants coming from the Balkans?
So, you know, if we're talking about the refugee population, most of the Kosovar and Balkan refugees who came to Switzerland during the fall of Yugoslavia did not experience the Saudi inroads that people who stayed inside Kosovo did. And in many cases, the very fact of acclimating to life in Switzerland and, you know, learning to be Swiss and learning about the country's traditions will have done a lot to ward that off. That being said, I looked into it before our talk, and before ISIS became a very well-known threat, it is true that at least a handful of extremist Balkan preachers have visited Switzerland and lectured there, including a Bosnian imam named Idris Bilibani. And again, I don't think any of that's happening anymore, because anyone's name who's affiliated with this kind of Salafi jihadism is very much on a watch list now, and they would no longer be allowed to freely lecture, I think, in most Western European countries. It's happened in the earlier 2010s, but not anymore.
Still, what has the Swiss government to do to contain this missionary activity?
Well, I think keeping an eye out for well-known Salafi jihadist names, like the preacher I just mentioned, is a good rule of thumb in terms of foreign missionary activity. I don't think a huge number of dollars are coming in, but anyone in any country, whether it's Switzerland or elsewhere in Western Europe, can access a lot of these sermons and texts online. So that's much harder, if not impossible, to control. But in terms of the actual visitation of some of these radical imams, I think that Switzerland has cracked down and should potentially continue to keep an eye on that.
I'm sure they do. Still, the question of the influence of Islam is a hot political topic here in Switzerland. And as you know, Swiss people have the right to vote on many things, also about such disputed questions. In 2009, the Swiss people banned, for example, in a referendum, the construction of minarets. That's now based in the Swiss constitution. And just a year ago, 51%, a bit more, a small majority, but still a majority, voters said yes to a nationwide ban on burqas in public. Are these sort of decisions helpful to counter the Saudi proselytization?
Well, I have to say, I have not been to Switzerland, and I'm definitely not a Swiss citizen. So there's a lot of dynamics that I cannot understand as an outsider. But with regard to some of these policies that crack down on a very small number of Muslims, in the case of burqa bans, which most Muslim women in these countries don't wear in the first place, and especially the minaret ban, it does contribute, I think, to a marginalization and problematization of Muslim identity in a general sense, which may contribute to marginalization among the Muslim population, which is small but has grown a lot in Switzerland in the last half century. I mentioned earlier that in places like France and Belgium, where some of the greatest numbers of ISIS foreign fighters came from, their policies of laïcité and very stringent applications of that, which is not exactly the principle in Switzerland, have most likely aggravated the alienation of many Muslim citizens and residents of those countries. So, you know, I think it remains to be seen, of course, what the effects of this policy in Switzerland are. But I think that it's a really tough question to find balance between secular values that are so important in a country like Switzerland and the kind of goal of not irreversibly pathologizing a Muslim identity. And I think a lot of European countries are working through that right now. And I'd be curious to see what the effects of the minaret ban are in another 10 years. I think it's only been about a decade so far. But a generation of Swiss Muslims growing up under these kinds of problematizing measures, I think it remains to be seen. But I think it's inevitable that some Muslims will feel unwelcome and uncomfortable because of things like that.
Thank you very much. I mean, so in the debate around these referendums, of course, the opponents of those referendums, they argued that it's a discrimination to ban minarets and burqas. So would you agree then?
I'm not 100% sure about the word discrimination. I guess I would want to hear more from people who are affected by it, if they feel discriminated against. But I think the overall, the effects of these combinations of measures to otherize Muslims, especially when there's so few people who would be affected by them, seems like it will certainly have some effects. But, you know, I have not spoken to burqa wearing women in Switzerland or France or Belgium about the effects of these measures. So I reserve my judgment.
Thank you very much, Krithika Varagur. I think she deserves an applause from the audience. I hope you can hear it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Christoph, for this amazing interview. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you. A last word from you. What would you like to say? What would you like to add? What have I missed out?
Well, I mean, I think this is clear from my what I've said so far, but I think the theme of my book is that a lot of developments are much more nuanced than the top line. So what I originally, almost everything I originally thought about what Saudi money was either complicated or turned on its head as I wrote this book. And if you think that project is in any way useful, you might enjoy reading it. But if you want a very obvious or clear takeaway, I think you could tell that that's not what you'll find in these pages. But I hope some of you decide to pick it up. And please let me know if you do. My email and website are quite open to anyone.
Thank you very much. Great talking to you.
You too. Have a great evening.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.